I have been talking about the story of vine stock transmission in Australia. In the first part of this four-part series, I talked about the very earliest days of New South Wales, the ambitions of the colony, and where the earliest vine stock came from. In this second part, I'm going to talk about some very important characters and the trade in vine stock material until around the 1850s. Of course, I must make mention of convict labour. Although conditions could be brutal, many convicts were assigned to settlers who had established farms. Some even lived in relatively compassionate circumstances. During the 1820s, the explorer and wealthy English settler Gregory Blaxland was making wine at Brush Farm. He was a rather unpopular, cantankerous, entitled, and untrustworthy character. But during this time, on two occasions in fact, he sent samples of his wines back to England, where his Brush Farm claret, actually made from Little Black Cluster or Pinot Noir, were awarded silver and gold medals by the Royal Society of Arts and Manufactures in 1823 and 1828. The wines had been fortified with 10% French brandy to preserve the wines on their long voyage to England, and they were the first international medals ever awarded to Australian wine. An important early wine figure in New South Wales was a Scot called James Busby, who arrived in Sydney in 1824 with his dad, who had been appointed mineral surveyor of New South Wales. Some people suggest that it was James Busby who lobbied for his father, a very respected engineer associated with the likes of Robert Stephenson, the famous lighthouse builder, Thomas Telford and George Rennie. While travelling out by ship, he wrote a treatise on the culture of the vine and the art of winemaking. This work was really just a translation of a work by Jean-Antoine Chaptal and completely irrelevant to Australian conditions. The book caused a local uproar in Sydney because it was deemed as being rather arrogant. But after working as a farm manager at the male orphan school in Parramatta, where he also taught viticulture, Busby went back to Europe to find a new, more lucrative position. On his way back, he stopped off in Spain and France, where he collected one of the greatest 19th century collections of grapevine material in the world. And according to some reports, he took with him 10 gallons of New South Wales wines from the 1829 and 1830 vintage. He was also partly sponsored by the MacArthur family, which explains why duplicates of his collection were planted out at Camden Park. This story is well known by Australian wine people, but of course this is not so well known by outsiders. James Busby picked up 437 varieties from the Montpellier Botanical Gardens in the south of France, and 133 varieties from the French National Collection in Paris. Through his MacArthur connection, James Busby also picked up 44 cuttings from the Percy family, the Dukes of Northumberland, at Sion House in London. The figures are not necessarily accurate, but by all accounts, roughly between 334 and 362 cuttings arrived healthy and alive. The collection comprised not three, but four parts. Firstly, James Busby's private collection, which was planted out at Kirkton in the Hunter Valley, north of Sydney, Sydney's Botanic Gardens, and the MacArthur family's Camden Park. This presumably also comprised vine stock from the Duke of Northumberland's Sion House. Secondly, the Montpellier or principal collection, which was transferred to Sydney's Botanic Gardens. Thirdly, the Luxembourg collection, which was known as the supplementary selection. And then the fourth part was a collection of cuttings from Jerez and Malaga in the south of Spain, but all of these perished on the voyage to New South Wales. Nonetheless, according to James Busby, he secured the best varieties available at the time from the very best wine districts of France and Spain. This included, crucially, Shiraz cuttings from the Hill of Hermitage and Pinot Noir cuttings from the Clos Vergeau in Burgundy. He also bought out Mataro, Grenache, Carignan and Dolcetto, Pinot Gris, Pinot Blanc, and he certainly brought cuttings from Champagne, and it is certain his Pinot Blanc was Chardonnay, which I will explain later. Soon after James Busby returned to New South Wales, he was appointed New Zealand's first resident, the equivalent of a governor's role. His involvement with the Australian wine industry faded from then on, but he enjoyed a stellar career in New Zealand. While James Busby's collection forms a crucial foundation of Australian wine, in my view, the MacArthur's played a much bigger and more profound role in establishing a colonial wine industry. Despite the early excitement, Sydney's Botanic Gardens collections did not prevail. If it wasn't for duplicate collections at Kirkton and Camden Park, our vine stock history might be completely different. Although it should be pointed out that some settlers did secure cuttings from the Botanic Gardens, and these included John Pascoe Faulkner in the Port Phillip district. By the 1830s, the MacArthur family were rich and powerful and well established. John MacArthur was now going insane, and his sons took over the farming and business enterprises. Brothers James, who eventually married, and William MacArthur, a bachelor all of his life, were inseparable friends and lived at their 5,000-acre Camden Park estate south of Sydney. Aside from their wool-growing activities, they also established a vineyard and a nursery comprising grapevines, plant material, and ornamental trees. William MacArthur, later Sir William MacArthur, was particularly energetic and was the most influential expert on vine stock material at the time. He was a marvellous man of extraordinary generosity and vision. He was a horticulturalist of immense wealth and scope, and although based in Australia, he was well known all around the world for his extraordinary interest in plants, especially grapevines. As the steam age progressed and travel and postal correspondence became more frequent and safer, MacArthur became acquainted with the great scientists of the day, including Charles Darwin and Sir Joseph Hooker. And any notable visitors to Sydney would visit Camden Park. These included later the great botanical illustrator and traveller Marianne North. You can still see her Camden paintings along with hundreds of other botanical landscapes from around the world at Kew Gardens in London. The Camden nurseries became the engine room of vine stock transmission from the late 1830s onwards. Many of the great early vineyards were stocked with Camden vines, including Yering Station in the Yarra Valley, Joseph Gilbert in the Eden Valley, and Ranella at Ranella in South Australia. The failure of some Busby imported material because of miscataloguing, neglect or availability was something of a concern by the mid-1830s, although Cabernet Sauvignon, catalogue number 55, was a part of the 1832 importation. William MacArthur was sufficiently motivated to order new vine stock material around 1836, and it arrived in 1837, perhaps using Wardian cases to ensure safe passage from Bordeaux. Given that the import material was accompanied by Didier Numa-Joubert, an employee of Barton and Guestier, this consignment could have comprised some rooted vines. Didier Numa-Joubert was an interesting character and quite entrepreneurial, and he also stayed in Sydney afterwards. In fact, he was the first person in Australia to use the daguerreotype camera. He also became a property developer, and with his brother, developed the Hunters Hill enclave in Sydney with its magnificent 19th century mansions. This 1837 imported vine stock material of Cabernet Sauvignon, Malbec, Petit Verdot, Sauvignon Cendré, and Semillon were crucial imports, as was Riesling, which was brought from the Rheingau in 1838, again at the behest of William MacArthur. During this time, he also sponsored families of vine dressers, or vineyard workers, from the Rhine Valley to settle and work at Camden Park. This was arranged by William MacArthur's brother Edward, who was living in London. The descendants of these families still live in Australia. So now there is a picture emerging by the 1840s of a more sophisticated ambition. The varieties talked about during the 1830s, like Sweetwater, Small Black Cluster, Black Frontignon, Verdello, were now supplemented with other varieties better suited to Australian conditions. Early settlers found it difficult to adapt to the contrasting season in the Southern Hemisphere, but as the years progressed, landowners better understood their ground and vineyard techniques. Acclimatized vine stock is used frequently in advertising material showing the viewpoint that homegrown cuttings were better than imports. The trade in vine stock material became a massive business during the 1830s and 1840s, and the Camden nurseries were at the centre of this trade, selling trees and plant material for those fine houses on Sydney Harbour and grand properties in the country. They weren't the only ones, but they were extremely prominent. William MacArthur had a special interest in viticulture and started writing a column called Letters from Marlow, which was syndicated through various newspaper titles around the Australian colonies. For those with a classics background, you will note the name Marlow refers to the Roman poet Publius Virgilius Marlow, or Virgil. When MacArthur planted his vineyard at Camden, he planted it using the quincunx system, or diamond-shaped pattern, that was promoted by Virgil. MacArthur recommended 19 grape varieties, and of course all of these could be obtained from Camden. They included Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, Verdello, Shiraz, which was the Australian corruption of Syrah, Cabernet Sauvignon, which was Carbonet, also known as Carbonet, Mataro, better known as Mourvèdre in Europe, Malbec, Petit Verdot, Carignan, Pinot Noir, Grenache. And the majority of these formed the core of Australia's fine wine plantings over the next 120 years. William MacArthur, with the help of his vine dressers and gardeners at Camden Nurseries, established the most important grapevine nursery in the Australian colonies. It was known that it comprised the very best of plant material available. And although there were other imports of vine stock material and other important nurseries, like Thomas Shepherd's Darlington Nurseries in Sydney, many of the avenues of inquiry actually lead back to the MacArthur's Camden Nurseries. It wasn't a monopoly, but the connections between William MacArthur and many early settlers were profound. After the colonies of South Australia, 1836, and the Port Phillip District, 1842, were established, William MacArthur's nursery business flourished. Camden Nurseries supplied many early vignerons, including the Penfolds, the Rennells, the Gilberts and Smiths in South Australia, and the Rari brothers at Yering Station in the Port Phillip District's Yarra Valley in present-day Victoria. As the colonies developed, MacArthur entered commercial agreements with other nurserymen, including John Bailey and George Stevenson in Adelaide, and John Pascoe Faulkner at Pascoe Vale near Melbourne. Camden Nurseries supplied directly to the new vineyards in South Australia and the Port Phillip District. Many of the early vignerons also supplemented their income by supplying cuttings to new settlers, including the Germans in the Barossa Valley. One example was the Rennell family, that took up wagons of cuttings for sale from Ranella. But small grapevine nurseries also existed at Angston and elsewhere, and so cuttings could be obtained from various sources, including neighbouring vignerons. In addition to his involvement in the Sydney Botanic Gardens and its grapevine collection, William MacArthur also had a big hand in the transmission of vine stock and the creation of the first botanic gardens in Perth from 1830 onwards. It is known that both Gregory Blaxland and William MacArthur donated cuttings. But of course there are other importations of vine stock too. But one of the main difficulties of tracking transmission is that cuttings were regularly brought in to various Australian colonies and ports by settlers or traders without any form of regulation. In the earliest days, settlers made the assumption that they had to survive on their own. For instance, Dr. Christopher and Mary Penfold brought wax-lined cuttings from South Africa. But after arriving in South Australia, they discovered that they could buy cuttings from nurserymen, particularly William MacArthur at Camden Nurseries, and perhaps later places like Bailey's Gardens, literally just down the road from McGill. The trade in vine stock material was also aided greatly by regular coastal shipping services between Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, Launceston in Tasmania and Perth. The development of the Wardian case during the 1830s was of great significance. Legidge's nursery in London exported and brought back plant material to and from Australia from 1833, widely using Wardian cases. And William MacArthur was known to use this advanced technology of the time, which was essentially a portable glazed glass house. For instance, the Adelaide Botanical Gardens brought in 50 rooted vines of sultana grapes from South Africa in 1867. But there was also a significant downside. The Wardian case partially promoted the spread of many pathogens and pests around the world, which would cause a devastating effect for the wine industry. But the idea that our early wine industry sourced all of its cuttings from South Africa is not right. Most Cape wine was increasingly seen as inferior, and nurserymen were also aware of poor performing vine stock, probably a result of virus problems. Certainly, by the 1860s, no vigneron in his right mind would be importing grapevine material for wine production from South Africa. But first I need to tell you about what people felt about Australia during the 1850s, because this has a crucial bearing on vine stock transmission and the ambitions of our 19th century forefathers. You know, Australia was about the most exciting place on earth during the 1850s. The discovery of gold in 1851 captured the imagination of the age. The combination of mineral and agricultural wealth attracted a massive influx of new immigrants from Europe, the Americas, and China. And increasingly, the invention of steam power propelled people and materials around the world at a rapid rate. Australia, once a place that was on the far side of the world and as inaccessible as the moon, suddenly became much closer, and the expanding British Empire offered huge opportunities. In 1850, the population on the eastern side of Australia was roughly 400,000 people, and by decade's end, there were around 1.2 million people. It would have been a lot more if it wasn't for the perceived harsh environment. Nonetheless, Victoria, as it became, and New South Wales were among the richest places on earth, attracting extraordinary entrepreneurial dreams, many funded by gold. But it also led to South Australia almost becoming bankrupt. Although gold was discovered in the Barossa Valley, it was not significant, and South Australia lost an enormous amount of its manpower as people rushed across the border to the goldfields in Victoria and New South Wales. And so many wives were left at home to man the fort. This was also the age of the great exhibitions staged in places like London and Paris and Vienna, where countries were able to showcase their wealth and export products. And these included mineral discoveries, patented machinery, steam engines, wool bales, agricultural produce, and of course wine. And the first of these took place in 1851 in London. One of the big breakthroughs for Australian wine, from New South Wales actually, took place at the 1855 Universal Exhibition in Paris. And one of the commissioners was none other than William MacArthur, who was knighted following its huge success. It is worth mentioning that this was the same exhibition where Bordeaux wine merchants, at the instigation of Emperor Napoleon III, introduced the first 1855 classification of Bordeaux wines and introduced the ratings of first to fifth growth chateaus. In the same exhibition, Emperor Napoleon III and Queen Victoria both tasted the wines of New South Wales and were completely impressed, enough to buy some wines for their own cellars. Well, perhaps it was given to them. The chairman of judges for colonial wine was Richard Owen, one of the leading scientists of the day, who founded Britain's Natural History Museum and invented the word dinosaur. One of the most influential scientists of the day, Justice von Liebig, was also captivated and reported enthusiastically about Australian wines. After a dinner with William MacArthur, Charles Darwin wrote to his old shipmate Sims Covington back in Sydney how much he enjoyed Australian wine. The optimism for Australian wine was remarkable, and many believed that Australia's future as the France of the Southern Hemisphere was assured. Against this backdrop was also the disastrous impact of oidium or powdery mildew. To give you an example, in 1852, the four first growths, as they were at the time, Château Lafite, Château Latour, Château Margaux and Château Aubryon, made roughly 60,000 gallons between them. And in 1854, they could only muster 5,000 gallons, just 8%. With the ravaging effect of phylloxera in France and other parts of Europe during the 1860s, you can start seeing the massive opportunities presented to Australian wine entrepreneurs. But more vine stock material was required, and certainly not from the Cape Colony. Cape wines were, as one observer said, so much inferior to those of older wine countries. Cape winemakers were approached by observers as being slovenly, and A.C. Kelly, one of Australia's great wine pioneers and scientists, was one of the main critics. So bad was the reputation of Cape wine that it was eventually rebadged South African wine. And of course, their wines have improved marvellously over the last century. You have just listened to part two of my four-part story about grapevines in Australia, from the earliest days of settlement to the present day. This podcast is produced by Andrew Kayard and Christoph Priddle at Annesley Street Studios in Sydney. Go to part three to listen to the next instalment,